This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Joining me in the studio is Kelly Warden.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, good. Before we go any further, though, a huge thank you to Jeff for another superb edition of On The Record. What a champion. And big thanks to Jeff for covering for us last week when we decided to actually take a holiday. I've been on a bit of a holiday for quite some time, so it's good to be back in the studio. For your Monday listening pleasure this morning, we're going to be covering a range of subjects. We're going to be hearing from Dan Hogan, who's from the New South Wales Teachers Federation. We're going to be hearing from Dan about a whole bunch of education issues in the upcoming election, looking particularly at the casualisation of teachers' work. So we're hearing from Dan a little later in the show.
And we've also got a little news package from a rally 2 weeks ago outside Parliament to ban the use of all white juries in deaths in custody trials. We're hearing mainly from Robert Eggington, who is the director of the Dungatar Aboriginal Corporation. So that's coming up.
We're also going to be chatting to local activist and man about town, Sam Wainwright. We're going to be talking to Sam a bit about the French presidential election. Emmanuel Macron, as you may have heard, won the election with 57% of the margin, with almost 95% of the votes counted last night. A lot of the liberal press is celebrating this as a win against the far right, as, of course, the main presidential competitor was Marine Le Pen, and so many people within the kind of liberal media are celebrating this as a win against the far right. However, it's a lot more nuanced, given the recent history of the Macron government and many of the attacks on workers and on pensioners and so forth under his neoliberal government. So we're going to be chatting to Sam a little bit about this election result and what it means to the people of France, and also more broadly what it means in the context of us heading up to an election here. What this sort of electoralism in the neoliberal era really means, and what perhaps those of us on the left, or those of us of social conscience, how we can engage in this this spectacle. So a lot of reasons to keep it locked to RTR this morning. We're going to start though with a track by Bombino. This is Awaranga, otherwise known as We Must. You're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. As you may have noticed, or may not have noticed, we're heading towards a federal election very shortly. And one of the issues that's being brought up by many around the country is the rights and the conditions of teachers. And Joni Boyd, Indie Media's Joni Boyd, had a chat to Dan Hogan, who's from the New South Wales Teachers Federation. And Joni caught up with Dan to chat to them about some of the upcoming election issues around for teachers, and particularly in regard to the casualisation of teachers' work. And Joni started by asking Dan what exactly are some of the issues leading up to the election for teachers.
Yeah, for sure. The biggest one, and it's sort of the one that all issues circle back to, is funding for public schools. The Morrison government has absolutely zero plan for fully funding public schools, which are currently, there's not a single public school in the entirety of the country that is fully funded compared to private schools, which they're all fully funded or overfunded. There's a great swath of independent schools whose funding exceeds 200%. So that's the number one issue surrounding education going into the federal election. Breaking it down, like the Liberal National Party has zero plans for 45 public schools. The Labor Party has committed to creating a pathway to full funding without any detail or dates around that. The Greens actually, in my opinion, have the most robust detailed and costed plan for fully funding public schools. Under their plan, they would have public schools fully funded by the end of next year, 2023. And on top of that, not only would they be fully funded under the Greens plan, but to be fully costed under PDO, school funding for public schools would be enhanced to the point that it would be no out-of-pocket cost for parents or teachers. Because at the moment, public schools aren't really, they're not free. You don't pay a fee to attend one, but parents and teachers have to fork out for resources, whether it's you're a parent paying for a uniform or you're a teacher paying for lesser resources like pens and pencils and equipment. That's my sort of crash course in what's going on in the upcoming federal election.
Yeah, so just on the coalition, I understand that in this recent budget, you know, there's a big cut for public education, but, you know, there's a lot more government money going into private education than there is public. Is that normal for a coalition government?
Normal for a coalition government insofar as we've had a coalition government for almost 10 years now. So previous to that, I'll be honest, I don't know too much before, you know, in terms of what the coalition was doing around public education before that, but certainly since the coalition government came in 2013 with Tony Abbott, it's basically just being a pork barrel right the way down. It's become so bad, actually, that the Australian National Audit Office, I think I got that right, ANAO, have commenced a review into the Morrison government's dodgy funding deals for the private sector. So they've noticed that, hang on a sec, why are you overfunding all these schools? Like, the deal is that you take the taxpayer money and you fully fund private and public schools. So they're currently doing an audit into it.
You are listening to RTRFM 92.1. We are speaking with Dan Hogan about education in the upcoming federal election. And we just had some issues with the line. But we were talking about why the coalition government funds so much more money into private education than it does into public education. Why do you think they do it, Dan?
Well, that's their base. So it's the way that they overfund private schools is just a pork barrel the whole way down. And it's caught the notice of the Australian National Audit Office, who are now conducting a review into the Morrison government's dodgy funding deals with the private sector in private schools, and their preliminary review has indicated that the Morrison government has quite squarely failed to monitor the way that they have allocated funds and distributed those funds in accordance with their legislative requirements. The reason that private schools are overfunded is because the Morrison government has deliberately overfunded them and is sort of playing dumb as to why they did so, even though it's in defiance of their legislative requirements. Like, within the legislation, they're not supposed to overfund private schools by 200%, especially not while public schools are, there's no public school in the land that's fully funded.
So on to other matters. So you're a casual teacher. What does that involve, and how does the casualisation of the workforce in general affect education and education outcomes?
Yeah, we're seeing the devastation that casualisation of the teaching workforce has wrought play out now, because there is a huge shortage of teachers across the board. So there's a shortage of casual teachers, which is where the teacher shortage is biting the hardest. And basically that has been procured by stagnant wages, overall workloads, and just in general poor working conditions for teachers that have gone on for at least a decade now, nationally. But to talk to my own context in New South Wales, for example, we had a term-long lockdown last year, term three, where every single school was locked down, it was remote learning, et cetera, et cetera. And what the government here did, who are a Liberal state government led by Dominic Perrottet, they kicked myself, I was a casual teacher then, I still am, but what they, I'm one of few that are left, and I'm one of few that are left is because what they did to the casual teacher workforce at that time was kick us all onto Centrelink. Like, they literally sent us emails just before term one commenced, providing links that we could get the dole or disaster payments.
Christ!
And I'm all for welfare. I've been on the dole many times in my life, but the problem that has created, because there was already a pre-existing shortage before lockdown came along. But then once lockdown lifted, so we go into term four, so that's like November, December last year, suddenly there's no casuals available. And the Department of Education at the state level and federally as well are left scratching their heads going, where did all the teachers go? And it's like, well, where do you think they went? They weren't waiting around for lockdown to end. They went and found another job. It's sort of the snake that eats its own tail. Unless you create a workforce which is happy with their paying conditions, they'll go elsewhere, let alone when there's a pandemic and a lockdown, you literally stand them down. They're not going to just return when you click your fingers. So that's
because unfortunately passion for teaching doesn't put food on the table.
Oh, exactly right. Exactly right. And you certainly lose that zeal or so-called passion when you get emails from, you know, the Secretary of the Department of Education telling you to, you know, head down to Centrelink. It was a baffling move because there was already a pretty severe shortage before that. All this has done is brought what was probably going to be a pretty severe shortage in a few years from now, like 2025, based on some modelling within the department. It just brought that forward to now. Every day this year that I've been in a classroom, I've had other kids from other classes also in the class that I'm covering because they don't have a teacher.
What kind of class sizes are we talking?
Yeah, we're talking upwards of 30 kids. So probably the worst I've had is 35 kids in a room from every stage level, stage one, stage two, stage three, which I think it might be delineated differently in WA. But basically, you know, year one, year three, four, and some kids from year five and six. And, yeah, 35 kids in the classroom in a pandemic is it's not ideal in not a pandemic either. It's not ideal it's not contingent with really good learning conditions. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a joke.
So you lot went on strike back in December. Can you tell us how that went? Like, what were your main demands, and did you make any progress on them?
Yeah, so our main demands were reduced workload and higher wages. And I think probably any teacher in any state or territory in Australia would have those demands. Some of our demands are specific to the situation in New South Wales. And New South Wales is an interesting one because public sector workers, whether they be nurses, teachers, train drivers, transport workers, whatever, we're all wedged under this thing called a wage cap. So that and we've been under it for 11 years now. So it means that our pay, which, you know, whenever the award comes up, we can renegotiate a pay rise for whatever we want. It can be 10%, 3%, 5%, whatever. But in New South Wales, they will only ever give you 2.5% as a maximum. And what that has done, though, effectively over 11 years, has driven our wages down. So our workload's gone up because our wages are capped. They can't go up in line with inflation. So inflation, I think, is at the moment 3.8%, and our wages just went up like a measly 2% or something like that. So there's a huge mismatch between the cost of living and where our wages have been heading year on year for the last decade. So our demand, one of those demands, was to abolish the wage cap, in order to, so that we can actually negotiate our wages to be higher than these piecemeal amounts, which in reality, because cost of living has just gone up every year, even though it looks like on paper, you got like a 1.9% pay increase this year. It's like, well, yeah, but the cost of petrol went up 70%. So, you know, it's actually a pay cut in reality. And then there's the crushing workload as well. Like, the reason I am a casual is because I was doing it full time and the workload's ridiculous. I was working a minimum of 60 hours a week. That was a good week. And anywhere 80 hours and up if it was like report writing season.
Bloody hell.
Like, it's just, it became such a joke. And I've been doing, this is my 10th year teaching, and probably 6 or 7 of those years were full time. And then the rest have been bouts of casual teaching. And every time I go back to casual teaching, it's because I've burnt out. But this time I don't think I'll ever, unless they like actually reduce the workload properly and meaningfully and materially, I will stick to casual or just exit the profession altogether.
Yeah, for sure.
A big rambling response.
No. Yeah. Do you have any plans to go on strike again in the future if you're able to talk about that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, it's like this. So New South Wales Teachers Federation, which are a part of the National Teachers Union, which is AEU, Australian Education Union, we've gone on strike in December last year. And then when this year began, we, as in the union, we said to the department, said to the Premier, look, we'll get off your backs for a term so we can get schools, you know, give them some decorum of stability given everything that's happened with COVID, and also it gives you guys, i.e. the government, a chance to come to the table on this and actually, you know, rethink how you're going to approach the problems in public education and come and talk to us about wages, talk to us about workload, etc. So the government, by the grace of the union, were given, it was an 11-week term, so they've had at least 3 months to, you know, come to the table, but they haven't. They're refusing to. So I would say that further industrial action is imminent in New South Wales in that regard, for sure.
Yeah, and we'd love to get you back on the show when or if that happens. So just back to the election. Labor is touted as having, you know, strong, deep roots in the union movement. As a longtime unionist yourself, especially with teaching, how does that resonate down on the ground for you?
Yeah, it's a funny one. Like, historically, yeah, Labor has been, it was the Labor movement at one point. And even today, they're what I would call a natural ally to the union movement. But I wouldn't say they're present in the union movement in the way that I see it in public education. Certainly, yeah. The union wants what's best for its members, first and foremost, who are teachers, who work in the best interest then of the students. So in that regard, while Labor might be the natural ally, if someone else has a better plan, political party wise, then great, we're all for it. I feel, and this is just my two cents, my hot take, I feel like Labor is in this weird sort of like a strange identity crisis phase where they want to be seen to be divorced from the union movement, but at the same time they don't want to alienate their base, who are staunch unionists. I see them kind of adrift, which is why we get this policy for them in the federal election where they say, yeah, we're going to create a pathway where public schools will be fully funded. And then the second question to them is always, cool, when will that happen? And they're like, we'll let you know soon. And so, okay, well, then what are the Liberals offering? What's the Liberal Party offering? Nothing. Okay, well, what are the Greens offering? They're like, oh, it'll be fully funded by 2032 next year, and it's going to cost $32 billion, and we've got some other plans beyond that to enhance and make public education truly universal. So, like, of those three, one obviously sounds a lot better. It's Labor is in. I'm constantly disappointed by their lack of I guess you say militancy, or even just not even militancy. That's a bit dramatic. Maybe just detail on some of this stuff. It's like, that sounds good, but then when you drill down, they're sort of. There's no dates or times or...
Yeah, just pathways to yeah. announcements to make a yeah. plan.
Exactly that. It's, yeah.
All right, well, I think that pretty much covers everything. Thank you so much, Dan, and we'd love to have you on again in the future to talk about the education sector and teachers' unions and stuff.
Yeah, lovely. Thanks for chatting to me. Yeah. Happy to chat any old time, Journey.
So just over 2 weeks ago, the WA Deaths in Custody Watch Committee held a rally at WA Parliament House. So the rally was to protest the use of all-white juries or juries with no Indigenous representation on trials pertaining to Aboriginal deaths in custody cases. Of course, there was also quite a strong focus on highlighting systemic racism in the justice system and in Australia as a whole. So this included talking about the over-incarceration of First Nations people and the fact that First Nations people in Australia are dying in police custody at alarming rates in the first place. So I went down there to catch some of the speeches and get an idea of what was being said. So yeah, stay locked in to 92.1 if you want to hear some more. Last year, when former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted for the murder of African-American civilian man George Floyd, it was a moment of reckoning that Australia is yet to have. Since the 1991 Royal Commission, over 489 Aboriginal people have died in police custody. And, despite mounting pressure from the Black Lives Matter movement and subsequent protests, still, no Australian police officer has faced a conviction for these deaths. Following recent court cases in which police officers have been acquitted for the murder of First Nations people by juries with no First Nations representation, pressure has been mounting to ban all white juries in Aboriginal deaths in custody trials. On April 7, the WA Deaths in Custody Watch Committee brought this issue to the steps of WA Parliament, where Dumwatun Aboriginal Corporation Director Robert Eggington said institutionalised racism was at the heart of this injustice.
We know that the racism that exists in this society in Australia is entrenched into every institution and establishment that governs the lives of all people. We call it institutionalised racism. It exists in the police department, and it certainly exists at the very heart of the judiciary system. It exists in the fact that all white juries acquit police officers and authorities from where it's more than evident that they've killed our young people, and they go free each and every time.
The most recent of these cases was the trial of Zachary Rolfe, a Northern Territory cop who was acquitted of murder by an all-white jury last month after he fatally shot Walpuri teenager Kumanjai Walker. Previously, in October last year, having fatally shot Yamaji mother JC on a suburban Geraldton Street, a police officer who had his identity suppressed was also acquitted by a jury with no Indigenous people.
When white people gather in such circumstances as jurors, prejudice creates a racist bias that screams out against the defence not to plead guilty as a prosecutor's case lays to rest, as the police sigh an assured relief.
Mr. Eggington shared a story about his late son, Robert Eggington Jr., being charged with several offences against a police officer at a Perth train station, but was exonerated in court by CCTV footage from the scene where the charges had allegedly taken place.
One horrid night, a hot December, he was on the train coming from the northern suburbs into Perth with two of his friends. Young Aboriginal men, 18 years of age. They were somewhat slumped a bit on the seats, and the next thing they found themselves on the floor of the train being belted with batons as they ploughed into my son's body. When the train got to the Stirling Street platform, there were 10 police officers, 5 security, and the West Rail security waiting for the three boys. They then put him in the back of the paddy wagon, took him to central lockup in East Perth. Just prior to the court's hearing, I went into West Rail's office and I demanded the CCTV footage off the platforms and off the train. My son was charged for the assault of the police officer on the escalator. His charge sheet read that Robert Eggington punched me in the back as he was being forwarded up the escalator and then turned around and hit the police officer behind him. That was the charge of the assault. It was misconstrued deliberately to enforce charges that could have bought years of my boy being in prison. But I had the footage of Bobbo being taken up the escalator, being again hammered in the back by batons, got to the top of the escalator, handcuffed to the seat. The judge said, "Where on the escalator, Constable, did Robert Eggington turn around, as you say, and hit you and assaulted you?" He put his head down and he said, "He didn't." "Where is it on the footage that you stayed on your charge sheet that Robert Eggington incited a riot?" Bobbo asked three black women if they could possibly video what was happening so they could use that against what they knew was about to come. That was the charge of inciting a riot. That footage saved my son. We can't trust the judiciary. We can't trust the police. We can't trust the court systems to convict any police officer in charges against our young. We can't.
WA Deaths in Custody Watch Committee Deputy Chairman Desmond Blurton echoed Mr. Eggington, saying all white juries are silencing Aboriginal people.
The police attitude has to change when they are dealing with First Nation people. No lethal force against our mob. Because if they do use lethal force, they need to be held accountable, because this murder, all white jury does not give our mob a voice. All white juries are racist, unjust, and unfair. We need our voices heard.
Awesome. So you just heard some snippets from a rally held at Parliament House about 2 weeks ago, and it was a rally to protest the use of all white juries on Aboriginal deaths in custody cases. And yeah, it was set up by the WA Deaths in Custody Watch Committee. Yeah, some pretty interesting stuff coming out of there, and some pretty harrowing personal stories of people who have sort of been inundated by racism in the justice system.
I'm going to turn now to France and the French presidential election concluding on the weekend with Emmanuel Macron's party winning victory, or Macron winning, with 57% of the votes, beating the far right's Marine Le Pen. Now, while this has been celebrated by much of the liberal press and the, I guess, you know, some of the, I guess, left commentators here in Australia, it's a little bit nuanced given the recent political history of Macron's government, the attack on workers, his attempts to, attack and destroy the pension system there in France, and a lot of the fight back that has occurred. And significantly, I guess, there's a lot of people in France who simply abstained from voting completely. To discuss, some of the politics and the ramifications of this election result, I had an opportunity to speak to local commentator, journalist and activist Sam Wainwright, who's been closely following the election. And I started by asking Sam whether this was, as many on the left are saying, a victory against fascism in the far right in France, or whether or not it was perhaps a little bit more nuanced.
Look, I would certainly say it's a good thing that Le Pen didn't win. So in that sense, it's a good thing. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that Macron's policies themselves are effectively the breeding ground for Le Pen in the first place. So both the policies of neoliberalism, so the increasing drive to job insecurity, privatisation, contracting out, which we're familiar with in Australia, but also the scapegoating, which exists in France just as much as it does in Australia, and in France, particularly in the form of Islamophobia. And Macron, in the last year or so of his 5 years, particularly resorted to Islamophobia, essentially trying to deflect attention from his own record of the last 5 years, and to neuter the appeal of Le Pen. And it's gone so far as to include the passing of a law against separation. Laws, Muslim community organisations, which are deemed by the Interior Minister to be promoting separation rather than integration, which, I mean, how exactly do you determine such a thing? It's quite Orwellian. And we've actually seen the main organisation in France that is responsible for identifying and calling out Islamophobia, so a not-for-profit community organisation whose mission is not religious, but to identify Islamophobia, it itself fell foul of this ban. So, for instance, now has to host its website outside of France. And it's also been made illegal in France to even support the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign in support of the Palestinians. So, yes, Le Pen not winning is a good thing, but it needs to be kept in perspective. There's something of a symbiotic relationship between the mainstream respectable right and neoliberal policies and the far right embodied in Le Pen.
And it's also, I guess, worth pointing out that Le Pen and other far-right candidates received a considerable amount of the vote. As you say, Macron's policies have really been the breeding ground for a lot of the, I guess, the re-emergence of the far-right in, you know, not just in France, of course, but around the, I guess, the European continents. I guess, inversely and unfortunately, the left didn't receive a significant, at least the far left, didn't receive a significant amount of the votes. But was there, do you think, a general sort of disillusionment with the election, given the lack of an alternative for a lot of people? And do you think that many people who find themselves very much to the left of Macron decided just not to vote at all?
Well, look, that's been a challenge in France for the last few elections, with the proportion of the people not voting at all steadily increasing. And France traditionally has quite a high level of participation, high level of engagement in politics compared to other countries. And it's not voting's not compulsory in France. So France has had one of the highest participation rates of any Western country, really. And it's worth bearing in mind that at this most recent election, although Macron won with, at latest count, about 18.5 million votes, and Le Pen around 13.5 million votes, more people abstained or returned a blank ballot paper than voted for Le Pen at around 14 million. So in a certain sense, you could say abstainers or non-voters actually came second to Macron. And that is reflective of the fact that there's a lot of people who, they don't like Le Pen, but they can't bring themselves to vote for Macron either. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind the last 5 years has seen, you know, a massive attempted attack on the pension system by Macron, which he had to back down on because of mass resistance. But people haven't forgotten that. There was his so-called eco-tax, where he cut taxes on billionaires and big business, and then replace that revenue with an increase of exactly the same amount, an increase on fuel tax, which he then claimed to be an environmentally friendly measure. And, you know, of course, there's people in France who are saying, look, I can't even afford to buy 4 new tyres for my car, let alone go buy an electric car. And that was very much the spark for the Yellow Vest movement we saw, which was brutally repressed. I mean, France justifiably has a reputation for having the most violent police towards protesters and kind of civil disobedience in Western Europe. So that really is the challenge for the left, actually, to galvanise that section of the population who are just pissed off and disillusioned and don't bother voting at all and can't see the value. Now, in his most recent presidential election, the La France Insoumise candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, made significant strides in reaching out to that layer, but still not enough to come second. He felt just short. But it is, you know, it is sobering to appreciate that of those people that did vote, around 75% voted for Macron or candidates to his right, and only 25% of the population voted for candidates to his left. Mm. So it's that layer of people that just don't bother voting at all. I mean, it was quite significant that this time around, Mélenchon, because Mélenchon also ran in 2017, got about 19% of the votes. So obviously, he picked up with around 22% in the first round this time. And so for the first time, we saw Muslim community organisations and migrant youth, in the outer suburbs of the big cities, starting to mobilise to support his campaign. That was a breakthrough. Still not enough, as I said, for him to come second and edge out Le Pen, which would have been a real pity. I mean, we can talk about the strengths and weaknesses of what we might think about Jean-Luc Mélenchon's program and campaign. But if it had been a second round runoff between him and Macron, that would have been so much better because it just would have changed the whole, you know, centre of gravity of the discussion. You know, I mean, the media would have gone hysterical in their attack on Mélenchon. Make no mistake about that. But that would have been a real sort of step forward. An interesting thing, and sorry to go on a bit of a tangent, but an interesting thing there is for the first time, Mélenchon in the lead up to this campaign has started to really come out strongly against Islamophobia, which is a real weak point for the French left. That could be a subject of a whole discussion by itself. But as Macron stepped up his attacks on Muslims to distract from his own neoliberal policies, Mélenchon finally sort of bit the bullet and came out strongly against Islamophobia and attended a rally against Islamophobia, which would have just been unthinkable for a mainstream kind of left leader a few years ago. So, I mean, I would say that the French left has still got a long way to go, but that was a very good sign for the future in terms of the French left understanding that Islamophobia in the modern era is not like, Islam in the modern era is the go-to scapegoat in most Western countries, and there's been a tendency for the French left to condemn all religion, including Islam, as if this was France of 150 years ago, and they are attacking the Catholic Church. But of course, 100, 150 years ago, the Catholic Church was part of the establishment, whereas most Muslims in France are part of the working class. You know, it's a very different situation.
Now, you mentioned there has been, recently significant resistance on the streets. We've seen, as you mentioned, the Yellow Vest movement, but of course the massive railway workers' strikes and other, industrial action. And it is kind of sobering, perhaps disconcerting, or perhaps just a product of the neoliberal reality we live in, where you can have broadly the left or the working class mobilising in huge numbers and resisting a neoliberal government, but then not turning up to vote for a candidate, as you've sort of explained there. The reasons for that might be quite clear in some respects. But what do you think it says about, electoralism in the neoliberal era in general? And, keeping in mind, of course, that we're very, very soon heading to the polls here in Australia, and for many of our listeners, it'd be difficult for them to really, consciously vote for either of the two major parties, especially around issues like the refugees and climate and so forth, when, as you know very well yourself, that both major parties, whether it's here in Australia or elsewhere around the world, are representing very much the same interests in terms of supporting big business over the interests of the common people. Do you think that this recent French presidential election really speaks to some of those limitations around electoralism in the sort of neoliberal era?
Well, I think it certainly shows that just how much people are disconnected from elections. And I think that's true in Australia as well. The other thing you see in France too is that the situation is more polarised. So polarised to the left and to the right. The other thing I think it helps us realise is that we'll only get you're only likely to get a serious breakthrough for a left project on the electoral sphere when they're struggling in the streets. And so it sort of reminds us that struggle on the streets is primary because, without struggle on the streets, who's setting the ideological agenda in society? Who's creating all the talking points? Well, it's the capitalist media. And so I think, to me, it makes it very clear that, that organic grassroots struggle is primary and electoral struggles then are secondary. They can still be important and they can still be catalysing. So I don't think we should. I certainly don't have like an anti electoralism or anything like that. But the real decisive struggles coming up in France are going to be the ones in the workplaces and in the streets. I mean, Macron has indicated that he wants to have a second go at his so-called reform of the pension system, and so he's going to face a big fight. And the fact that the level of struggle by workers and communities has actually been on the up recently. Sort of stands France in pretty good stead. I mean, things have still gone backwards in France over the last three decades. Things are not perfect there by any stretch, but for the most part, those defensive struggles against neoliberalism have been successful in France to a level that they have not anywhere else in the Western world, and that's because working class organisation has not been fundamentally broken in the way it has in Australia or Britain or the United States.
That was Sam Wainwright speaking to us about the election results in France and more broadly about, I guess, electoralism under neoliberalism. And this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Now time for a bit of indie media news.
Yeah, awesome. We've got some international headlines coming up. So first up, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron. has welcomed his re-election after he was voted in for a second term this morning. On Scott Morrison's Twitter this morning, he said he wished Mr. Macron and France every success, and particularly Mr. Macron's leadership in Europe and as an important partner to Australia. Obviously, diplomatic relations between Australia and France has been quite tense following Australia's decision to scrap a multi-billion dollar submarine contract with France in favour of nuclear-powered vessels with the AUKUS security pact. Chinese internet authorities are trying to take down a viral video montage depicting the poor conditions of citizens living in the Shanghai lockdown. The six-minute montage features audio clips of the local population criticising insufficient food supplies and complaining about poor medical conditions. Shanghai's 25 million residents have been shut in their homes for weeks while officials try to contain a severe COVID-19 outbreak. And in the war in Ukraine, a new satellite image has shown mass graves outside the besieged city of Mariupol in what Ukrainian officials are saying is evidence that Russia is burying bodies to cover up their war crimes. President Biden says the US will send another $800 million in military equipment to Ukraine, as well as another $500 million in economic assistance. Biden's announcement came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continued appeals to European countries for more weapons.
And in Israel, Israeli warplanes bombed the Gaza Strip last week, targeting what Israel said was an underground weapons factory. This comes as in occupied East Jerusalem, at least 20 Palestinians were injured last week as an Israeli soldiers fired stun grenades, rubber bullets and pepper spray to clear worshippers from the Al-Aqsa Mosque after dawn prayers. This follows a similar crackdown a couple of weekends ago that saw hundreds of Palestinians arrested and over 15 injured. Last Wednesday evening, Israeli police in Jerusalem blocked a march of more than 1,000 Israeli protesters from reaching the old city's Muslim quarter as many waved Israeli flags and shouted death to Arabs. In other news in the United States, in climate news, a wildfire burning north of Flagstaff, Arizona, it exploded in size last week to nearly 20,000 acres, fanned by high winds and fueled by dry grass and brush. Arizona and other western states are suffering an unprecedented mega drought brought on by the climate emergency. 11 large wildfires are currently burning across the southwest and southern plains, with some 8 million U.S. residents under fire alerts. And that's about all we've got time for this week on the Indie Media Show. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks, Kelly.
Great.
We'll be back next week at 11 a.m. You can always restream the program at rtrfm.com.au. You can get in touch with us via the offices here at RTR, or of course via the corporate social media.